Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to another episode of New Books in Poetry. I'm your host, John Eversole, and I'm delighted to be joined by the poet James Franco. His first full-length book is Directing Herbert White, published by Grey Wolf Press, and he has also published a chapbook of poems titled The Strongest of the Litter from Holly Ridge Press. In addition to these two volumes, his poetry has appeared as part of various art projects, ones like A California Childhood, Hollywood Dreaming, and most recently, Magic Mountain Home Movies. Every poet has their obsessions, and for Franco, they are childhood and the teenage years, gender, sex, innocence, and the workplace he knows best. And within these poetic frames, we're introduced to various characters and voices, landscapes nearly worn out with memory and elegy, and a repertoire of imagery that is often both tender and violent and always striving to be accurate. Franco is our poet of earnest grotesquerie, favoring clarity over vagueness as he depicts the bizarre zones of early experience that crash against poems of adulthood that occupy spaces most readers do not have access to, film, celebrity. And yet Franco's poems seem to argue a kinship exists between the world of the adolescent and the world of a movie set. And each of these stories of existence intersect in Franco's poems, complicating the distinctions between sincerity and artifice for a speaker who seems simultaneously anchored in both of these perceptual districts. In addition to Franco's fidelity to the bramble of childhood memory and the glittering industrial complex of show business, his poems are deceptively musical, especially in poems like My Place and the cycle of Beatty, sonnets in Magic Mountain, often employing internal rhymes, but more impressive is his ability to hear the tiny voltage of music in individual phonemes, creating a sonic landscape one might miss if you don't read the poems aloud. Beyond the sound, the poet's use of punctuation, yes, punctuation, especially his employment of the comma, is brilliant in that it rejects the current trend in contemporary poetry of eliminating punctuation altogether in what is perhaps an exhausted homage to Merwin's Lyce. But more importantly, Franco uses punctuation to accomplish two things: to control the pacing of a line, and therefore allowing him to toy with silence, and to also clue in the reader when his voice takes on a more stately disposition or a more conversational one. When the book Directing Herbert White was published, it made a big splash in the otherwise small pond of the poetry world. And it reminded me of what Franco does best, complicates society's notion of the artist and the dynamic and at times rigid communities they inhabit. James Franco, welcome to New Books and Poetry.
Thank you.
You know, before we get into the poetry, I was hoping we could kind of go back and discuss a little about the landscape of your childhood and your teenage years and adolescence. Where were you born and raised, and what was it like growing up there?
I was born and raised in Palo Alto, California, which is about 45 minutes away from San Francisco. It's where Stanford University is. Went to high school right across the street from Stanford. My parents went to Stanford and met at Stanford and loved it there so much in Palo Alto that they went back there and started a life there. You know, when I was growing up, I guess I couldn't really appreciate how nice it was there. I was kind of a brooding young man. I got into, you know, a fair amount of trouble, at least for Palo Alto. And, but then when I got out, I went to UCLA and moved to LA, and I realized, special place Palo Alto is, and more than that, that it had a really big effect on me, that, you know, I knew a lot of people that when you talk about high school or they talk about, you know, growing up, that it doesn't mean much to them, that they want to just forget about it, or, you know, that they've moved on in their lives and they're not very interested in who they were when they were younger. Right. And for me, it's sort of the opposite, that, it was a time of, a lot of change for me, but it was also the time that I found basically, you know, maybe in, you know, in kind of inchoate forms, but it's when I found everything that I'm interested in now, and, you know, literature and acting and film and all of that, and so it, and art. It's when I really kind of started engaging with all of that in a serious way, and so it's that period has really been fruitful for, you know, my work, and just it's really kind of a time of life that I can use to explore a lot of the, you know, bigger things that I'm interested in.
Yeah, I was thinking about, so you probably were growing up in the 90s and stuff, and you teach a lot of kids that might be considered millennials or something, and, you know, when I was growing up, my parents, like, had a very, like, hands-off sort of vibe about it. I was very much, like, immersed in that landscape of adolescence. So the camaraderie of friendship, and getting into trouble and sort of railing against what was, in a way, as I saw it, like, a general safety, because I had grown up in, you know, kind of just a normal American suburb. And I thought, I got a sense in my friendships, because I too kind of look back at that time of life as kind of mysterious, strange, and charged, and critical to kind of my entrance into the contemplative life, strangely enough. And I sense in your own work that, like, that there is this certain depictions of, or I don't know, I get your sense of it. I felt like growing up, sometimes I resented sort of this kind of homogenous safety I was constantly in. But at the same time, I had a family that let me, you know, vanish for the entire day. And so I was wondering, did you kind of navigate kind of the teenagers feeling sort of a simultaneous, like, lack of authority around, and also, you know, that at the same time, you have no freedom, like, everything is chosen for you. And I always sense that tension kind of in your work. Were your parents like, you know, like today's parents, like, I'll ask my class, how many of you guys consider like you're like really good friends with your parents? And almost everyone raised their hand where I don't know if that was true for me. What about you? What do you think of any of that?
I had really good parents. My mom, they met in art class at Stanford. And then my dad gave up art, and he actually went to Stanford. He grew up in Chicago, and he went to Stanford because he wanted to be a poet, and Ivor Winters had taught there for years. And so my dad went to Stanford hoping to study with him, and then the year that he got there, Ivor Winters had left. this guy, Ken Fields was now running the poetry program. Ken Fields is still there doing the, Stegner Fellowship thing.
Right.
And I guess for whatever reason, my dad gave up poetry, went into art, and then he went into business. And my mom, stopped painting and became a children's book author. And so, you know, they exposed us, me and my brothers, to art. And, my brothers and I were all pretty artistic growing up. My middle brother, Tom, is a sculptor and painter now. And the youngest one, Dave, is an actor. And, so they were pretty supportive of that. Although, I don't know. My dad was sort of conflicted. You know, he appreciated art, but he'd also had this, you know, he then went to business school at Harvard. And so he had this kind of respect for business and all of that. Yeah. So he was always kind of pushing math and all those things. And I, like I said, kind of was getting interested in art and literature. And so he wasn't so high on that. But after a while, there's really nothing he could do to stop
me. Yeah, it's interesting that he like sort of embodies kind of these two impulses of like business and mathematics and poetry, where one is like seems hyper practical, and the other is kind of the beauty of poetry is its impracticality in a way. That he embodied both, and that your mom was, you know, also an artist. That must have been kind of an amazing household. But I do want to get back for a second to like this idea that the teenagers or the adolescents is like this kind of creative well that you go back and sort of like explore. We can get to that later, but you brought up, UCLA, that you went there, and then it's true that you dropped out and then sort of reemerged and reconnected with your love of literature, is that correct?
Yeah. I'll just finish the answer there. You know, in my work, I feel, you know, when you're a teenager, at least when I was, you know, before the internet and all of that, we did, you know, my friends and I did have a, you know, kind of a lot of freedom, whether it was because we would lie about where we were going and do what we were doing, or just because, you know, it was the suburbs, and at least at that time, you know, you're sort of free to roam.
Yeah.
And so there was a sense of freedom, and at the same time, because we didn't have the internet, I did, in some ways, I did feel sort of culturally starved, that I had found some influences that were very important to me, and I started watching the movies of Gus Van Sant at that time, My Own Private Idaho, and George the Cowboy, and I was getting into literature, mostly at that time, mostly novels, you know, William Faulkner and Melville, and you know, Hemingway and Steinbeck, like all those guys, you know, that's sort of what was around. And then, you know, I'd see some theater in San Francisco and that kind of thing. But, you know, like the big movies that I was sort of expected to see at that age, you know, were not, you know, it was just sort of like big 80s sort of blockbusters or early 90s kind of thing.
Totally,
And, you know, I just, there was no way to sort of access, at least I didn't at that time know how to access anything other than that. And so,
like, why don't you think you were able to? Because that's interesting. I grew up in the epicenter of plasticity.
I just didn't know about it. You know, it wasn't, like, it wasn't around. I mean, you know, we kind of, you know, we'd go to Berkeley every once in a while and see a band, like the first band I ever saw was Soundgarden at the Greek in Berkeley. And, you know, music was maybe kind of an influence. I had a lot of friends that were in bands. But I just, you know, I guess I just wasn't even really aware of anything other than sort of the mainstream kind of cultural event. So I think, you know, when I look back at that time, there was, you know, this kind of yearning and for something more and, maybe at that time not quite finding, artistic guides or influences or parents.
Yeah.
And that's a concept that's really important to me. Like, so when I did go to UCLA, I was an English major, and then I was in LA, and I saw, you know, everybody in LA is in the film industry, and and suddenly it seemed like getting into the movies was actually, you know, at least a possibility that there were, you know, practical steps one could take to do it. And so, so I left UCLA to go to acting school because I wasn't in the acting program at UCLA. And then after, you know, 8 years or so, I hit this period that I've seen a lot of people go through. Hit, like, especially actors where, in their mid to late 20s where they realize, like, what acting is, and especially acting in film, and that, you know, you only have a certain amount of control over the work if you're only an actor, you know, if not producing stuff, or that, you know, you turn in your work and then somebody else, you know, edits it and all that.
Like,
and
you
so,
kind of have a lack of agency of your own creative sort of.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And so I was looking.
Yeah, I could be frustrated.
I was kind of unsatisfied. And even though I was in, you know, a lot of big movies and so I was looking for answers and I realized I could go back to school. And so when I did go back, UCLA, you know, let me come back, I realized, I was still in the English department, and that so many of my heroes, you know, my writing heroes, were actually teachers.
Right.
And that if I went on to graduate school, they would be my they could be my teachers, and, you know, in effect, it would be, like having, you know, Danny Boyle, you know, direct me in a film, to have, you know, Tony Hoagland as a poetry teacher, or you know, Michael Cunningham, you know, as a fiction teacher.
Right.
And hold on 1 second.
Come in.
And so I just kind of threw myself into school in a crazy way. I realized if I did go to graduate school that I would not be able to act as much for, you know, a couple of years. And so I just decided, okay, well, this will be my time. This will be my sort of school time. And,
Was that a scary decision?
I'll just go at it full on. So I went to a lot of schools at once. I went to four graduate schools at once.
Yeah, that's pretty fucking insane.
Yeah.
Well, let me ask you.
But also on the other hand, you know, a lot of my fellow students were holding down jobs. Yeah. You know, at the same time, or they were teaching while they were, you know, studying, and I didn't have to do that. You know, so like all the extra schools were sort of like in place of a job.
Yeah. Was it scary to sort of make that decision, or was it kind of you had some clarity about it and it was a no-brainer? Because, I mean, imagine once you're immersed in sort of the film industry and then you're like, hey, I'm going to take a hiatus. Was there ever like kind of like, I guess what I'm asking is, was there any risk in doing that? Like professional risk?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, you know, nobody, when I first started talking about it, you know, nobody in my film world, you know, was that excited, you know, and it, logistically, it was pretty tough, you know.
Yeah.
I did end up paying a lot of my own money just to kind of travel from place to place. You know, I did 127 hours while I was in graduate school, and so I'd, you know, fly from Utah in the middle of the night to New York and go to class and then fly right back and that kind of thing. And, but it was fine. You know, it was, I was the one who wanted it, you know, and I made the decision. And so I just did whatever, you know, it took.
Yeah.
You know, I was also, and again, about, you know, my own particular situation where I, you know, I was in movies, I was sort of known, and, you know, I realized maybe some people wouldn't be so excited about me being in writing programs or, you know, that kind of thing. And that, you know, I also knew, like, when I eventually published that there would be a lot of skepticism and all of that. But I guess I just had to weigh all of that against, you know, my desire to do this and to do it seriously. I mean, part of going to school was to treat it as, you know, seriously as possible and, to, you know, not have it just be a hobby, then in fact make it as important as my film work or anything that I do.
I know, that's crazy. And it sounds like you didn't even like really have a model to look at and be like, oh, other actors have done this. They've immersed themselves in graduate programs after having like a stint as an actor. And, it kind of is like crazy that you had the tenacity to do it and then still like fly around the country. It sounds somewhat like taxing and lonely, but you know, when
it was okay. I mean, you know, now I have friends all over. You know, I made friends at all the different schools. So
it was actually
pretty nice. It was sort of like a midlife renaissance or revival or something where I had a whole kind of new life.
Yeah, you
and a whole new host of collaborators.
Yeah, it sounds like artistically a lot of things crystallized out of your work in the MFA programs. You've talked, in another interview about, you know, your experience in the MFA programs, but I only heard you talk about in a previous interview about the NYU experience and then the fiction program. It might have been at Columbia, and you're really like kind of setting up this juxtaposition between the collaborative spirit of the film program where the writing fiction program was, you know, maybe some of your fellow students were like keeping an eye on you and shit. But you never spoke about, your experience in the poetry MFA. And I was wondering if you could draw any comparisons to your experience between working in the fiction workshop and working in the poetry workshops.
Definitely. I mean, I've been to, I don't know, I think, let me think, 1, 2, 3, 4. I've been to 5 different kinds of MFA programs, or five MFA programs, art, poetry, two fiction, and one film. And they're all more or less based on the workshop model where you do the work, whatever it might be, and then bring it into your peers and, yeah. And your instructors for, ostensibly, constructive feedback. And exactly. I think that's not a bad model, especially it's very valuable to me, especially early on, because, it forced me to, you know, show my work to people. It was, you know, as simple as that. Like, I hadn't really shown much of my writing or anything.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I'd been writing, you know, all those years between when I dropped out and when I went back, but I really kind of kept it to myself. And because of that, I think it suffered. You know, I didn't, when somebody else reads your work, it's just different. You know, it then becomes, you know, about what's being communicated, not just, you know, putting your inner thoughts on paper. It's like, how are you actually communicating with another? And it reads differently. I mean, Tarantino, when he won for the best screenplay for Django, he said something like, thanks to everyone who listened to my screenplay. You didn't have to give notes or anything like that. All you had to do was listen. And I think, you know, for me, that's the concept of like, yeah, of course, when he reads it all out to somebody else, it sounds different. And, and I think, you know, I think Steinbeck did the same thing. He just have, you know, his wife listen. He didn't even need sort of feedback. He just needed to hear what it was. And filmmakers will say the same thing, like when they do test screenings, like they don't really need the feedback from the audience. But all they need is to sort of sit in that room with that audience and they'll know like what's playing and what isn't. And right. The film will suddenly look different. You know, it's suddenly the moments that you thought were just right suddenly feel like they're dragging on, or, you know, or something happens too quickly. You just see all that once you have other eyes on it. And so that was very valuable in the MFA programs. But the different disciplines, you know, they work differently. You know, when you're writing you're usually kind of working on it alone, and then or short stories, and you bring it in, and same with poetry, and then everybody, sits around and critiques it. And so it's sort of like, even though it's supposed to be constructive criticism, it's still sort of one versus all.
Yeah.
And,
it was like a built-in antagonism almost.
Yeah. And then when, I don't even know what the scholarship situation was at Columbia or Brooklyn College. Yeah. Cause I was, you know, I wasn't going to be eligible for that anyway. So, but my guess is, that if there were some people on scholarship and some weren't, that, you know, that sort of thing would find its way into the workshop, that, you know, criticism could maybe not be so pure because maybe somebody was unhappy about somebody else getting a scholarship or whatever, or maybe just plain unhappy that they were, you know, paying $40,000 or more a year for something that was not going to, you know, be paid back, you know, anytime soon. Like, you know, all of that stuff, I sort of feel like maybe made its way into the workshops.
That's interesting. I think I know what you mean. Like, the MFA program is, it kind of sets up this, you know, whether you call it an institutionalized cafe or sort of this artificial sort of fishbowl to put a bunch of writers in. And of course, like, I think both of us believe a lot of value can come out of that. It does sort of, it might tap into people's, you know, maybe not their better impulses. And then, so when that individual is asked to read your work, critically and simultaneously objective and just kind of respond organically to your work, there might be some wires crossed there at times.
Yeah. And then, you know, and then sometimes you just have, you know, you just have the other thing that you have to learn, you know, that you learn in MFA programs is who you want to listen to and who not to, and how to not listen to the ones that are not helpful. You know, in a sense, it is sort of like high school where you are put in a room with a bunch of random people that are not of your choosing to it's sort of help you, you know, with your work. And so
it's kind of messed up.
But, you know, out of that, you know, Michael Cunningham always said to me, like, what you want is to find, you know, one or two good readers of your work that you can keep for your life, you know, hopefully. And I think I did find that.
That's great. Well, it's interesting.
What it also pushes you to do is to, be able to critique others' work, hopefully. You know, it is an important skill, and it's one that, you know, now that I'm a teacher, I practice all the time, and I think it does help me a lot to really sort of, to really engage with someone else's work and see what she's trying to do and help her along her path, not my path, but her path.
Right.
I think it's important. And for me, it just strengthens my own sort of, creative impulses and ability to translate, what I have in my mind, you know, into the work.
Yeah.
By kind of working on others and helping them along the same path.
I think that's really cool that you bring that up. Two things is back to real quick, the aspect of the audience. I think you're like right to say that, like, once you sort of like have an audience or a listener, as we were talking about, like a tangible, physicalized listener, it sort of brings to the work, it allows you to maybe take at least a couple steps back from the work and see it differently. And it makes it more real. It makes it more, like kind of tactile in a way, because the listener kind of gives writing, sort of it kind of like lets go of its abstraction a little. And also that I think you make a great point now that you've been through workshops and now that you are running workshops that, you know, I didn't think about it because we were talking about people's kind of negative feelings in the workshop and how they get hung up on those, but it is a great sort of sight of empathy, you know, and I think that is where we get into like community building and having empathy for the writer as a teacher. I thought that was really smart, but real quick, was there, you know, was the vibe any different between poets and fiction writers? I only bring this up because when I was at Columbia in the poetry, you know, the fiction writers used to like, it was like high stakes for them. You know what I mean? Like they were like, had this idea that like getting agents and making a living at this, while us poets were like, we had no illusions about that. So we kind of carried ourselves differently in the program, I think. I was just wondering if you saw any differences when between just kind of the people you encountered, between poetry and fiction and maybe even film, if you want to bring that in.
Yeah, totally. Well, I'm sorry. What did you say at Columbia? It was,
no. It's really cool. Yeah. Like just that there was this kind of distinction between the fiction writers and poets, you know?
Yeah.
And that there seemed to be something a lot more kind of, something more practical at stake for the fiction writers as far as like, you know, there was the promise of making a living as a writer coming out of that program, as opposed to the poets didn't have any illusions about, you know.
I see. Yeah. Yeah. So there's this, totally. And I think my experience, in the poetry program was also largely, a function of, the place that I was at, Warren Wilson, which was incredible.
Yeah.
But in general, you know, because there's almost very little chance for, you know, a poet to make a lot of money off of poetry. It's this idea that there's, you know, very little economic capital to compete for.
Yeah.
And so it becomes, you know, poetry, the poetry world, I think, becomes a place of, you know, great competition for cultural capital.
I think that's exactly right.
And so they can, you know, the poets can turn in very vicious and just fighting for the little bit of, you know, critical capital that's there. Because that's all there really is.
I think that is really a smart observation, especially at times on a community that prides itself on, shunning, like, say, the negative review or having, like, an authoritative inclusiveness. Sometimes, like, it gets vicious, you know? But you're right. Like, that's,
well, especially because in the literary world, you know, authors review other authors. Like in the film world, that, you know, doesn't really happen. Like,
yeah, that's
filmmakers
really true,
don't review
yeah.
other filmmakers. And so it's almost like the workshop all over again, where you have peers, like, you know, reviewing work, and maybe it's not even peer reviews. I don't know.
Right, right.
But Warren Wilson was great. Of all the MFA programs I went to, it was run very, very well. I think partly because it is a low residency program, you know, so you go for a couple weeks twice a year, in North Carolina. And so there's not, you know, there's not too much time to really kind of get mad at anybody.
Yeah, or, that's you really know. True, right? Yeah. You're only spending like X amount of time with these people in a way.
The other great thing is, after a while, you know, I kind of got a little tired of the workshops, just because I really liked my instructor's feedback, but I, you know, wasn't loving a ton of the student feedback. And at Warren Wilson, you go and you get an advisor for the semester,
right,
who you correspond with, and he or she is the only person that reads your work for the semester. So it's great. You just get very focused attention from, you know, some of the best poets writing now a lot today.
Yeah,
and
it kind of, sorry to interrupt, but it kind of mimics that older style of mentorship where, you know, like kind of pre-MFAs, you would hear about these kind of tremendous, like, literary relationships between different writers. And it sounds like that low residency matrix sort of tries to mildly replicate that, maybe.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Hemingway and Gertrude Stein or Sherwood Anderson. And it's definitely more like that kind of model. And they really do push for a it's not soft. The criticism is not soft, but it's also not judgmental, meaning they strictly enforce a certain kind of reading of others' work where you're looking for intentions, and then once those are established in the workshop, then the group tries to assess if those intentions are being met.
Man, and that's kind of
if
novel,
not,
actually,
how they can be helped along.
Right.
And so it does really create a different kind of environment in the workshop.
Right. That's interesting about intention, because kind of traditionally that's like completely almost irrelevant, in the sense of like the poet or writer is supposed to remain silent to the tyranny of kind of this collective reading of their work. And it's like, at times the writer would probably like to pipe up and say, no, well, this is what I'm trying to do, you know, and it's interesting that they do that. So let's like kind of turn our attention to directing Herbert White. a lot of those poems, I think it took you several years to sort of get this manuscript together. Can you kind of give us the life cycle of that book?
Sure. So most of that work was done while I was a student at Warrenwilson. And I extended my time there. It's a 2-year program, but you can take extra semesters if you want. And I just got so much out of it that I think I, instead of 4 semesters, I went 6 or 7 semesters and had 6 or 7 advisors who, you know, were just incredible poets, Tony Hoagland and Ellen Bryant Boyd, and Rick Barrett, James Longenbach, Alan Shapiro, Alan Williamson, and shoot, one more that I can't think
of
right
now. You memorized a lot. That's really good. So a lot of those poems were like kind of your, like, you were working on those, on poems and directing her away.
Yes. And, yeah. So I worked on them there, and that is, Warren Wilson is also where I was introduced to the poetry of Frank Bidart.
Right.
And he's not a teacher there, but he teaches in Cambridge, and then I think Strathmore.
Yeah, that's right.
And this, in one of the workshops at Warren Wilson, this poet named Gabby Calva-Caressi brought in Frank's poem, Herbert White.
Yeah.
And,
let me stop you real quick. I made the mistake of bringing that into a freshman class one time and they were horrified. I want to ask you, and I know I didn't mean to interrupt, but as you're kind of thinking about the impact of that poem, you know, it's visceral, grotesque, it kind of has a backwoods psychotic vibe to it.
Yeah.
Just in the back of your mind, after we talk about directing her, the poem, and talking about your book more, I do want to get to, kind of your feeling of kinship with Cormac McCarthy and Faulkner, because it sort of dovetails into the vibe I sense in directing Herbert White in a way, you know? Mm. But tell me about that poem when you first encountered it. What was your reaction?
Yeah, well, it's interesting you bring up Cormac McCarthy and Faulkner. I think because they were sort of on my mind at the time, too. I mean, I was doing a lot of programs at once, and so what started happening is a lot of the projects I was working on started to meld, meaning I had taken a I'd actually taken a Cormac McCarthy class with a great poet at UCLA, Calvin Bedient.
Yes.
And
it was a whole class.
So that class. Yeah, it was a whole class. I guess Cal was trying to write a novel or something,
amazing.
And so he wanted to do a class on McCarthy.
That's great.
We read basically all of McCarthy's work.
Wow.
And so coming out of that class, years before Warren Wilson, I was only starting to direct movies, and I wanted to, for whatever reason, I was very struck by this short sequence in McCarthy's book, Child of God, which is about this necrophiliac. And, it was just a sequence where it was like, as grisly as it sounds, it was fascinating to me. It was a sequence where the character first discovers, a dead body and comes upon the idea that he is, you know, he's so lonely that, and so incapable of having a relationship with a living person that, the dead body is actually perfect because he can control, you know, both sides of the relationship. And so I wanted to do that as a short film. But the McCarthy's agent said, no, we don't want to break it up into a short film.
Yeah.
And so that was sort of on my mind. And then when I was at Warren Wilson, I was also at NYU, and we had to do at that time that Gabby Broad and Herbert White, we were getting ready to do these short films that were supposed to be adaptations of some previous source.
Yeah.
And so when I heard that poem, I think Nabokov said, like, when something feels right, you get like a tingling in the back of your neck or something like that.
Yeah.
That's what I had. And I just knew, like, oh, this is what I want to do. And strangely, it was very similar to the McCarthy kind of sequence that I wanted to do.
Right.
And it's Herbert White is about a necrophiliac. And I don't, it's not like, I don't think I'm a sick person. I don't think Frank Bedard is a sick person. I think for me, it was really about the idea of, in Child of God, the idea of loneliness and wanting love so badly that you'll do, kind of anything. In Herbert White, I think it's more about, having a compulsion that is so strong you're unable to stop it.
Yeah.
And it being such a dark sort of addiction that you are unable to tell anyone about it. If you have a drug addiction, there are places you can go, but if you are murdering people and their bodies, you can't go anywhere.
That's just
a secret you have to carry. And for me, it was sort of a great way to sort of examine or dramatize the secrets that we all have. All feel that we have something or whatever that we don't want to share for whatever reasons, and to make it such an extreme thing.
Yeah.
Just kind of brings all the tensions to the fore. And so after that reading, I just read all of Frank's stuff, and then one of my teachers at NYU actually had done a documentary on Frank and introduced me to him. And from the first conversation on the phone with Frank, we just got along. Frank's such a film lover, and it was the year that I had done Milk and Pineapple Express.
Yeah.
And you would think that Frank, a poet maybe would know Milk and talk about Milk, but he not only talked about Milk, he talked about Pineapple Express and that, some of the nuances of the performance that he liked and all of that. So, we got along from the very beginning, and talking about kind of readers of one's work.
Yeah.
He is sort of my main reader when it comes to poetry.
It's crazy when you meet somebody who just like their suggestions on your work like ring true every time they give one.
Yeah.
You're like, oh my God. Real quick, it's funny that you talked about like, those hidden kind of wickedness things in us that we all carry around and how and we don't have to talk about it for long, but it made me think, and I don't know, maybe I heard it somewhere. It's like how the internet in many ways has like robbed us of our own wickedness being sort of private now, like we can't carry around our own kind of damning sort of impulses, that they've all been sort of physicalized in the internet. And then also the fascination with the corpse. I mean, I think McCarthy does this and directing Herbert White. It is like the fundamental symbol where like we are made completely and most aware of kind of the materiality of our body,
and so
it's really just compelling in that regard. So when you think about Herbert White or the Child of God, it is like on the surface kind of horrific and sort of pathological, but in fact it might be the kind of crystallization of longing and loneliness to connect with something, and while also being like maybe just for whatever reason, being unable to. It's really fascinating. So the poem.
Exactly. So that was sort of that experience, was maybe one of the key moments behind the book. And then obviously there wasn't always a title for the book, The Directing Herbert White, but, I think after a while of, just, working on it and then working on, you know, the so many drafts with Frank. And then really, there's a titled poem in the book to directing Herbert White that, is directly inspired by, one of not only the experience of working with Frank on, adapting his poem into a film, but, one of his poems called, Writing Ellen West.
Right.
Yeah. So Ellen West, you know, was one of his other kind of major early poems.
Yeah, that is like anthologized like crazy.
Yeah. And, I think partly just because, people don't want to anthologize Herbert White. The necrophiliac is much. But those sort of were the two poems from his early period that kind of stood out. One from his first book, one from his second book. And, by the way, so you went to Columbia, so you had Richard Howard, right?
Yeah, I was going to say Richard Howard. And he wrote that intro to, Bedard's first book.
Yeah, he was the editor. He edited Bedard's first book.
And, when I was thinking about my ideal reader at Columbia, I used to go to Richard Howard's apartment, and he would fucking blow my mind with his edits. I'd be like, oh my God, how can you? And he would do it like casually on a clipboard, you know, like it kind of blows me away. These readers, you know, but sorry, go ahead. What were you saying?
Yeah, I took one of Howard's lecture classes. It was pretty incredible. A little crusty as he, you know, expect, but incredible.
Yeah.
Incredible.
It felt to me that you were expected during his lectures, which he had meticulously written out, that you were meant to sit there and listen and like, do not raise your fucking hand or he would look at you like you're insane. He also gave me, I missed one class and he like gave me like a lower grade. I was like, what? Anyway, yeah, he was great. I mean, like I said, he was a person that advocated for my work, published it, I think when he was poetry editor at Western Humanities Review. So yeah, I have nothing but like really good memories of him, but yeah, it's crazy that Bedard, Richard Howard, connection. And sometimes I think Bedard, he edited Robert Lowell's collected, didn't he? Something
he
like
did,
that.
Yeah, Bedard's, I think, big influences were, Lowell and, Geography 3.
Well, it makes me think how these writers
What's her name? No, tell me it's one of the most famous poets ever. Her name's something.
Is it a female, or?
Yeah, Geography 3 is the big book.
Oh, Bishop, Elizabeth Bishop.
Yeah. So Elizabeth Bishop and Lowell were his sort of mentors. Lowell had been his teacher at Harvard.
Yeah.
I guess Bishop was just a friend, but, they were, I think, the major influences on him.
It's amazing the generation of writers these guys sort of inhabited compared to today. I feel like, I mean, they've just been canonized. That's why they feel fantastical.
Yeah.
But I was going to ask you about your style in poetry and how it relates to like some, and I want to get to Magic Mountain for sure, because I found that completely fascinating. But that your style is like pretty like accessible, that you don't use poetry for like avant-garde procedures, or, you know, you don't get into like really, you know, and that's interesting to me because it tells me that you're actually interested in communicating with a reader, like, you know, understanding the communicative impulses of language rather than kind of materializing language into something you sculpt and try to create new meanings with. Was that like something you chose? Is that something in poetry you're not interested in exploring? Like there's something like terribly conceptual about the poems. You know, they're straightforward and you're communicating.
Exactly. So, a lot of that comes from, being at Warren Wilson. You know, there was a real, especially having Tony Hoagland as my first teacher. You know, if we look back at like the poetry I applied with compared to, you know, the book directing Herbert White, like you wouldn't think it was the same person. Like,
yeah.
I came out of, at UCLA, I had,
which I imagine is pretty experimental.
I had Cal Bedient and, I had this other woman that was very sort of experimental. Oh gosh, what's her name? This is a little strange. I'll get her name in a second. And so it was very sort of, I don't know what you want to say, sort of ungrounded, much more, I don't know even know how to describe it, just sort of experimental, and when I got to Warren Wilson, looking at Tony's work, Tony's essays, and then on top of that, Tony introduced me to a couple books that were highly influential. So, C.K. Williams's book, Tar.
Oh my
which
God,
I then,
dude,
yeah, which I then turned into, a feature film called The Color of Time with my NYU student.
No way.
And then, a book called, The Clerk's Tale, by, gosh, all these names are coming out of my head. gosh, he's a friend of mine too.
Wait, what was the title?
The Clerk's Tale.
Spencer Reese.
Yeah, Spencer Reese. Yeah, so I adapted that title poem into a short film, and
yeah, I remember reading about that. Yeah.
He's a friend of mine now, and so Tony's work, Frank's work, C.K. Williams' work and Spencer Reese's work, I think, are, huge models for me. And C.K. Williams, I got to know him a little bit just from adapting his thing. And he passed, I guess, in the last year.
Yeah,
but unfortunately, I got to, work with him. And he's actually in the movie, Color of Time.
Oh, that's great.
Well. Yeah,
he would not turn his eye away from things, for sure.
Exactly. And so he even, when I talked to him about it, just to sort of try to understand the impulses behind his book before adapting it, he said that there was a period when he was, after his first couple books, when he was thinking about giving up poetry, that it was, too taxing mentally, I guess. And so he even considered going into movies. He thought, oh, maybe I'll write screenplays and that'll be easier. And realized that, wasn't for him. But that.
But you can see what was attractive.
Right before he wrote Tar. And Tar is sort of, really where he kind of broke out in, the long line.
Yeah.
And the poems become almost like little scenes or little, sequences of scenes.
Totally, yeah.
Almost like mini movies or mini moments.
Yeah.
And they do, they do break out into, lyrical moments and,
sure.
more abstract moments, but.
You're right, they're highly
but
cinematic.
They're grounded. Yeah, they're grounded in scene and drama and character. And that, to me, that was, that was a revelation. And then, in Tony's work, he is sort of a, postmodern confessional poet or whatever. And so he's almost always, a character in the poems. Frank does that a lot too. What I really liked about Frank, and what I think I use a lot in my book, or in you can even see in poems like one about Lindsay Lohan, or maybe the series about Warren Beatty.
Yeah.
The idea of sort of wearing a mask, having a character be a mask for the author. So if you look at Frank's poem, Herbert White, on the on the surface, you know, there's a murdering kind of crazy man. But if you read underneath, you know, some of the other situations in it, there's, you know, in that poem, it talks about Herbert's father, you know, leaving the mother and starting another family. It talks about, you know, it takes place in, Bakersfield, California kind of environment, which is where Frank grew up. And so you start to realize that Frank has, infused this crazy character with a lot of his own DNA and his own experiences. And so I really like that idea of having a surface mask or surface character, but, putting very personal kind of, attributes or components underneath.
Yeah, it's interesting being able to like use the persona or mask as like, you know, that somehow it liberates you from the burden of your own autobiographical self, you know, and I can definitely, that is really kind of liberating.
And I think what Richard Howard said in Frank's intro to the first book, and Herbert White is the first poem in that book, is that in Golden State, the first book that, I think Richard Howard said in the intro, or I heard it somewhere, that if he really pushed Frank to make it the first poem, because if people kind of read that and understand, okay, clearly that is not a confessional poem, that then when they get to some of the other poems later in the book that are, you know, do feel a bit more autobiographical or confessional, that they'll be read in a different way, that they don't need to be read exactly as, you know, confession or autobiography, that instead they're read as poetry, despite the fact that there might be some connections to Frank's biography.
No, that's pretty brilliant. Yeah, putting that poem forward like that kind of allowed for like almost like an aesthetic hangover on the other poems in a way. Yeah.
Right.
That is really interesting. Yeah. That's crazy. So
so in my book, you know, I do have my subjects, you know, youth and coming of age and performance and identity, and also, you know, the film industry and all of that and celebrity. And so, I think my book is full of these masks or, wolf mirrors, but underneath, you know, it's sort of the combination of a sort of looking at, you know, the very personal or confessional, but through these, you know, funhouse mirrors of Hollywood.
And I think it's interesting in your disposition that you're drawn to, you know, when we consider childhood or teenager years as sort of like this experimental innocence, kind of a laboratory of innocence being kind of remixed, and then drawn to these real dark sources like McCarthy and Faulkner and Herbert White, that there is this weird like kinship between those, maybe in the child, since they're not so burdened by the narratives or scripts of society, that they're somehow sort of more open to these darker energies. And often teenagers feel like that. And then in the
adulthood. Well, I think, you know, I mean, I guess for me, you know, I always thought one of the early Faulkner stories that I loved was, The Bear. Right. And it's really a coming of age story and about this boy, you know, kind of growing up, and there's this, you know, mythical bear out in the woods that all the hunters could never catch. And his coming of age is really told through this hunting narrative. You know, that is sort of the world, you know, whether, you know, Falk was a big hunter as a kid or not, I don't know, but it was sort of the environment that he grew up in.
Yeah.
And I grew up in the suburbs, And so kind of thinking about what we were talking about earlier of this, feeling culturally starved or whatever. Not that I, you know, wished I had, you know, hunted when I was a kid, but that, you know, a lot of these old rituals, are gone.
Like these rites of passage.
And yeah, but we still had these sort of violent impulses, but they didn't, you know, if we didn't play sports, it's like they didn't really have anywhere to go. So we just sort of became destructive sometimes.
That's interesting, man.
And so for me, you know, I love, you know, those great writers, you know, and they, a lot of them just tend to be Southern writers, but yeah. When I, you know, when I make movies, it's sometimes, I guess, easier to kind of make work that is not directly, inspired by, you know, my own experiences, that I'm more able to make a leap into other worlds that I didn't grow up in. Yeah. But I guess when I'm generating the initial work, and I'm not adapting something, I write about, you know, my world. And I have a similar, you know, a lot of times I'll have a similar kind of desire to explore, you know, maybe the darker sides of humanity, or at least even if they're not the darker, you know, just this explore love or whatever you could say, like in a case of Child of God, but through, you know, darker kind of storytelling devices.
Right.
I have maybe a similar impulse. It's just that the setting is different than those guys.
Yeah, I think that's exactly. Yeah, like in some of your poems, it'll kind of create this like kind of you know, kind of landscape that's recognizable to like a lot of kids that grew up in there. But what you at times do, and I think these other books do maybe to excess at times, is they insert that like very subtle violent image to sort of like upset the kind of equilibrium of these kind of hyper artificial, maybe suburban childhoods we had, where we were constantly also sensing those darker impulses and through the violent image. And it kind of, you know, I watched the Coen brothers Blood Simple for the first time for some reason, recently, and the way they kind of frame kind of gore or violence is always kind of, it's almost lyrical, but it always shocks the surface of the scene, but they don't do it excessively. And it reminds me of some of your poems that do the same thing, like, you know, describing the teacher's face, I think in second grade, to, I think, poultry or chicken parts. You know, it's like, oh, shit. Yeah. Okay. Like, kind of throwing in that little bit of grotesquerie and having that upset the innocent landscape of childhood, I think is like something I definitely felt growing up. And I imagine it must be sort of ubiquitous for, maybe it's a pre-internet, childhood. I don't know. I think that's an interesting thing that you brought up earlier, that maybe these things are like so accessible now, those kind of depictions of, whether, you know, I could not watch somebody be beheaded when I was in fifth grade or whatever, you know what I mean? It's like, Jesus. So I think your work does that, like, you kind of like slyly put in these moments of, the grotesque, and they're kind of padded with youthful innocence. And I think that's a really effective thing.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. It's really great. And then, I wanted to ask you, because a lot of, like, I noticed, like, your poems, they seem to like shuttle to different platforms. So like, I don't know why I didn't catch it, but like Splash Mountain, for instance, is in Magic Mountain. And I thought, like, that's so strange because, and I think this is where you kind of sense the multidisciplinary artist in you, is that these poems are kind of porous between projects. Is there any thing behind that? Like, you're like, hey, I could put poems over there in this other project or whatever. And it's interesting that you like have, you see a relationship between the poetry and and in the case of at least, you know, these other books, kind of the visual arts. And I'm wondering if there's any, like, sort of kinship you see between kind of poetry and these more, like, kind of visually artistic projects.
Yeah, I mean,
Or are you just, like, throwing poems in for the hell of it? I don't know. in these projects, you know?
I did, you know, I wrote, my first book of fiction was Palo Alto, this connected short stories.
Yeah.
And I went through, you know, I did the whole kind of traditional kind of thing, you know, it was a sort of regular book and, you know, went out and got reviewed and, you know, it got a kind of conventional form. It's like a book, you know, so I'd written Palo Alto and then, but I was at RISD at the time and sort of going back to that, kind of what we were talking about before where a lot of the things I was doing started to blend. And so I was doing a lot of, you know, visual art and, really kind of, with similar subjects. And so I thought, why just do, you know, why not make a more of an art book, you know, with a lot of material where, you know, some of these things can live together that are, you know, these different forms are exploring similar subjects. So maybe there's a form that could blend them. And, so I did this book called A California Childhood that had a couple stories from the Palo Alto collection, but also had some new stories and then had poetry. It had, and then it had images, you know, it had photos from my actual childhood, even though the text was more or less fictional, although it was fiction that was based on experiences that I'd had. And then, and then there were images of art that I had done throughout my life from, you know, childhood to the present. And all of the art and poetry and fiction was sort of about youth and childhood and coming of age. And it was also a blend of fiction and nonfiction. And so, I kind of really liked the energy that was created out of that collage.
Yeah.
And so when, the woman who published that book, Magic Mountain, came to me and said she wanted to do sort of an art book, I thought, great, let's do another one. It started really with the images, but then I had, you know, a series of poems that I thought would just go well with the images and not necessarily, you know, literal commentary on the images or vice versa, or, you know, and the images aren't really illustrations of the poems, but, thematically and, exactly. Subject wise, they sort of blend.
Yeah, they're sort of the same vibe and family, definitely.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, exactly.
Yeah, and there's like a nice simultaneity to it. And I think that's how like people are experiencing visual text and regular text, you know, is like these kind of hybrid forms. I think it's like kind of reads naturally. And speaking of reading, so we'll wrap things up. I thought, if you're up for it and you got the pieces in front of you to read three poems, My Place, out of directing Herbert Wyatt, and then Splash Mountain and Beatty, Sonnet Number 1.
Yeah, you got it. Great.
All right, cool. And if there's anything you want to say about any of the poems before you read them, whatever, that's cool.
Sure, I will. Okay, here we go. So, Beatty 1. So this is the first of a series of sonnets that use Warren Beatty sort of the subject, but for me, this kind of idea of a sonnet sequence, started in Herbert Whitehead, a sequence of sonnets about films. And that came about from one of my teachers, Rick Barrett, who sort of was pushing me to do, you know, write some poems that were a little more traditional and kind of traditional forms, and and then I kind of like this idea of trying to encapsulate films or aspects of the film world in sonnets, almost like these are like the sonnet is almost like a short film or something like that, or like a short kind of bio pic or something.
That's what I that's what they feel like. Little, like, especially the Warren Beatty cycle is like a little, I felt like I was watching a little biopic.
So that's sort of how these came about. Cool. So this is the first one.
Cool.
81. There be a thing that is but of all importance when we think of living on this earth. That without it, jungles would desert turn, and races, plentiful and varicolored, disappear into plain milk or desiccate. But there is a force that cannot be placated, that breeds itself like chemical addiction. It is the fountain that feeds prediction. It is love heed to passion, sex, of a peculiar order, the kind that is best when someone is master, someone slave, on her knees for Master Beatty, the babe, who graduated to Casanova, the king of Hollywood love, because love is the thing.
Yeah, that is really great. And then, like, when we turn to, I don't know which one you want to read next, either Splash Mountain or My Place, kind of, it's always weird to me to juxtapose your kind of, your poems of sort of insight into Hollywood with the more autobiographical, you know, childhood, teenage years poems. It's just interesting to see, to see the speaker kind of shuttle between those two worlds, you know?
Right, exactly. Well, yeah, I'll go to My Place if you want. This is really inspired by C.K. Williams, and you know, there were a lot of little portraits in Tar, and a lot of it seems like, you know, there is a central speaker that is maybe a stand-in for C.K., but in other times, you know, he's kind of looking out at other people and, you know, veterans and, kind of lonely people in his world. And so, this was kind of inspired by that. This is called My Place. My Place. I have a bucket on my wheels and a mop, and sprays for windows, toilets, and desks. Children write things in all places. Fuck you, Ronnie, for a good time call. I was supposed to wipe off all the graffiti, especially swastikas and racial slurs. There's a hallway outside the math building full of faded brown lockers caged in with wire fencing. Halfway down this hall is a door, and inside there, my place. There is learning happening all around me all day, but sometimes I stay late when there are no more bells or voices. An orange freeze above the buildings, soon gray, and then purple when the school lights turn on. I can sit in my room all night if I wish. There's an industrial sink and a chair, and I have papers and notes and receipts, and a single bare bulb on a chain so I can see. Each morning, I wash my hands and face, but it does no good. When kids miss the toilet, I'm the one that cleans. When it's clogged, I put my snake in there and clear it. There's a faculty bathroom in the office building called the Tower Building. The one unit bathroom is for staff only, but students sneak in there and do it. In my place, there's complete privacy. Not many are aware of it. I keep the door closed, I don't even look at the girls anymore. I love movies. I watch them on my little portable. And the kids are gone. I don't even look at the girls anymore. I love movies. I watch them on my little portable. When the kids are gone, the school is a different place. A shadow place. I'm a shadow.
Thanks, James. That was awesome. Just like, I don't know if you ever did this, like in elementary school or middle school, like on off school days, you would go like roam around your school. And like the buildings would be completely like it would demystify it as a place of normalcy in your school was something like foreign. I always get this in that poem when you like point out like the industrial sink. And then you're right to bring up C.K. Williams with that, with when the kids miss the toilet, I'm the one that cleans. That is so perfect. Jesus. That's so awesome. All right, let's go to Splash Mountain, which as somebody who grew up in Orlando, I really connected to.
All right, cool. So, again, you know, I think, you know, for me, yeah, just, you know, we talked about earlier kind of juxtaposing innocence and, you know, these flashes of violence or sexuality in the middle of that. Yeah. And I think that, for me, that juxtaposition is really important. And because I don't know, I guess, you know, the juxtaposition sort of heightens the effect, I guess. But also, you know, in reality, we are hit with all these different kinds of, you know, experiences or information or whatever all day long, you know, and some of them are, you know, sometimes it's really violent or, or, you know, the way that our personal lives and our public lives, are intertwined is very weird, you know, that there is all this violence or sexuality kind of underneath, you know, so many sort of mundane things. And and so for me, the use of, you know, innocence and kind of younger characters heightens that.
Yeah.
That kind of juxtaposition. And then Disneyland, of, you know, as a kind of a place of innocence is, you know, even more heightened. So,
yeah, I think that's great. And I just want to add on real quick to that is like, and I was just reading this book sort of about it, is like the older we get, the more sort of rigid our self gets, that we're less porous to like kind of the mysterious things in life. And I think one thing, and we think we're in control, right? Like we control like, suffering, we can control our mortality if we just do the right things here and there. And I think childhood is not so much obsessed with that rigidness, and so it's a lot more like open to these kind of like these different energies that we kind of maybe block off in adulthood, except from like I think the artist is continues to be open to that. But then like violence is like kind of a fuck you to your sense of control in the world. You know, and so to combine like that violence in the zone of innocent youth where it's sort of also open to it. It's a powerful combination. I think you definitely, have just tapped into it. And it's like, there's something like spectacular about it. And it is the same vibe you get in McCarthy and these, you know, Herman, these other writers that really like seem to know how to tap into that. But, Splash Mountain, you're right. Like, what a great poem of like kind of propping up this like this fantasy land. But then I'm gonna let you read it, but and then we can talk about it real quick and wrap things up. So go ahead, whenever you're ready.
Okay. Splash Mountain. New Orleans Square is my favorite part of Disneyland. I spent two New Year's Eves on one of the balconies there watching the Mickey Mouse fireworks. Sad and searching for something good. Tom Sawyer Island used to be across the way, and now the Swiss Family Robinson tree is gone. When I was young, my dad bought us guns from the pirate shop. When we were older, we fingered girls in the haunted house and went down Splash Mountain. We went through Pirates of the Caribbean, pirates raping pigs and women, raiding and rivalry, men tortured and gold taken, treasure and rape, and the boat floats so gently down the way. I want to get out and sit with the old man on the cabin porch.
That's so fucking awesome. Because the Pirates of the Caribbean ride is so trippy, especially when you're young. It is, and kind of the automatic like figures they had are so sort of like 20th century technology that it screams that uncanniness. So as a kid, you're like, treasure, rape, crazy pigs, what is happening? And then you just wait for that fateful like waterfall drop. That was really great. Well, James, I'll let you go. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me on New Books and Poetry. I've really, really enjoyed it.
Me too. Thank you, John.
All right. Bye.